Boom! It's time! Boom! We're not going to answer the question of is there life on Mars. We're going to leave that to a man with lots and lots of money. Instead, with our meagre funds, we've bought some beer and some recording equipment, and it's time to record Linux Voice Podcast Series 3 or 4. We're not quite sure at this stage. Episode 14. I'm Andrew Gregory.
I'm Ben Everard.
I am Graham Morrison.
And I'm Elon Musk. I'm Michael Saunders.
And in this fun packed Linux pack, free software packed voice packs episode, we've got news. We've got discoveries or finds. Again, I can never remember. We have a halfway reminder, possibly. We've got definitely got some neurons.
We do.
And we have a voice of the masses. If you like the sound of that sort of thing, but don't want to sit through bletherings, in which case, what are you listening for, you fool? If you'd rather read it on paper instead, but in a far more professional manner, you can go to shop.linuxvoice.com and subscribe to our works, like Ozymandias in the desert on his plinth, immortal there, carved in marble, but in paper form and with no DRM.
Is there DRM on Ozymandias' marble carvings?
I wondered what you were going to say then.
No, there isn't, is there? Anyone can come along and 3D print a big block of marble.
Put some paper over it and rubber wax crayon.
Exactement. So, do we have? Is there any more boilerplate stuff, or can we crack on with the news?
Can we crack on with the news?
Yeah, why not?
Right, news. The first news item this fortnight is some Lenovo Ultrabooks aren't running Linux. They're refusing to. This is the Windows Signature Edition, which has led some people to believe that Microsoft's hand may be sullied in this particular fiasco of persuading Lenovo to create this hardware that won't run Linux. Lenovo have said, no, it's nothing to do with that. It's to do with some shoddy RAID controllers with poor support. And, well, I guess we'll never really know the truth, but they definitely do have shoddy RAID controllers with poor hardware support, which is preventing the kernel running on them.
As I understand it, these Windows Signature Editions mean you basically get Windows without a load of adware and malware and stuff like that. Is that right?
Yeah, and the fact that that's even a thing makes me a little bit sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a pain. So without all the rubbishware?
Yeah. So you pay extra and they don't install any rubbish on your computer before giving it to you.
What a world.
But, yeah, something we don't have in the Linux world, fortunately.
Yeah, they don't put a load of cruft in there, but then you can't put Linux on it. Apparently that makes sense in marketing world, but I don't understand it myself.
So this is something to do with the RAID driver existing only in Windows to allow Windows to boot from the BIOS that is restricted to only allow disk access from this crufty RAID software.
Basically, it only works if you break the disk controller in a particular way. And because Linux disk controllers actually work, they're not broken in a particular way, the RAID controller won't work.
That has to be on purpose. Why would engineers at Lenovo want to dedicate their effort and sully their brand with such a poor piece of hardware?
I think it's a long time since Lenovo gave up caring about sullying their brand.
But they used to be brilliant. They used to be the company making IBM's ThinkPads.
Yeah, they did. And they, to be fair, they do still make some good laptops, but they also make some dross as well and some stuff that is so broken it won't boot Linux.
I noticed, actually, you've got a Lenovo there on the desk.
Yeah, I have. I'm reading the news off of Lenovo. I hadn't even noticed.
Mike and... sorry, not Mike. The other two. Maybe you should explain why you can see each other's laptops.
Yeah, well, I'm actually at Ben's house. I came over to Ben's to play today, and we thought we'd stay and do a bit of the podcast as well.
Yes.
And also, we've only got one pair of headphones, and just like I used to at the back of economics, sorry, Mr. Sanders, I'm sitting here sharing a headphone with somebody at the back of the class, although we're not listening to Stevie Nicks.
Yeah, so Should we move on to the next item of news? Next up on the news list is Vim 8 has been released. This is their VI improved editor that is pretty much VI on every Unix system for the past, 100 years or so. Come out with version 8, which is 8 versions in however long Vim's been going, is one every quite a lot of years.
Yeah, what's interesting about this version is so many of the changes in it have basically been sort of pushed into it by NeoVim. There was a fork a few years ago called NeoVim, where people wanted to take the Vim code base, which was absolutely ancient. You know, it ran on old Amigas and Atari STs and Vaxes that looked like fridges and God knows what. And Bram Moulinar, the maintainer of Vim, has done a good job over the years, but he's been very careful about taking in new changes. And the NeoVim guys were like, this is a great text editor. We need to do lots of big changes so the plugins can run properly in the black background. You can have background jobs and stuff. And Vim wasn't suited to it. So NeoVim did all this. NeoVim got all the modern developer attention, you know, just like Xorg or LibreOffice, got all the attention. And then Bram's like, we need to get all this stuff into Vim. So both projects are actually progressing really well because of this competition. So it's a good old free software success story. Most of the things are about background jobs and the fact if you want to run something, if you're editing a big file and you want to do a bunch of processing in the background, you can now do it much quicker than before.
Sounds excellent. I think they should have called it neoconservative Vim.
I still don't really understand why you have background jobs running in your text editor.
Oh, Ben, you see, this is what happens when you really get into a text editor. Like, I mean, I love Vim, but the Emacs guys, what the Emacs guys do is like a whole other world above this, like running their entire day-to-day schedules in Emacs and stuff.
Running Emacs with an Emacs, that's the thing that really gets me.
Well, yeah, Emacs is a sort of okay operating system. It just doesn't have a good text editor.
Whatever happened to the old Unix principle of do one thing well? A text editor edits text. If you want to run things in the background, run them in the background, i.e. not on your text editor.
Right. So in Vim now, thanks to... I should plug my electric cable in. My laptop's running out of power. In Vim now, you can run a background task to, you know, perform checking on your code, perform linting and stuff like that. Do you really want to save a file, exit out, perform this lint operation and come back in? You must admit, surely, that there are some things that make sense to do together in the same program.
I refuse to admit that.
So should a text editor even save, or should that be handed off to another program?
I just take a picture of my screen and then run that through OCR.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah.
That would explain the typos.
Yeah.
Fixes quite a few of them.
In any case, it's a huge step forward for Vim. It's modernizing the code base enormously. A lot of it has been brought on by this NeoVim fork. So I think we can all be happy with that.
So is there still reason for the NeoVim fork to exist, or is this...
That's a good question, and I don't know enough specifics about it, because NeoVim has been going off into many, many other directions and ripping out so much old code that I suspect NeoVim will still have a future, but
there's no wall then that's been put up between NeoVim and the old Vim to stop bits of old Vim getting over the wall.
I presume not. It didn't not that long ago. It looked like Vim may, you know, simply die out, like X.org, or you know, that everybody would move to NeoVim. But now that Bram has become more responsive to major updates to the code, they may both go on for a while, but yeah. Things like that is, I don't think they're particularly counterproductive forks. I think both of them have their reasons to exist. So yeah, we can enjoy it. Two great text editors.
Okay, so if you like running jobs in text editors that shouldn't be done in text editors, Vim 8's for you. And next up on our news this fortnight, let's have a look at some security news now. This is a massive breach of the Yahoo, 500 million accounts breached. That's like one for every 16 people in the world. And it's considered, it's suspected to be state-sponsored, which I'm pretty sure everyone means China, but everyone's afraid to say it's China.
Suspected by whom? Is it just that Yahoo have said, oh, it's terrorism, when actually they've been lame, or what?
Well, I guess there's no real way to know for sure. But if they're...
But why should we give credence to this rumour?
Okay, there's been an attack that may or may not have been state-sponsored on Yahoo.
And I think it was Script Kiddies in Glasgow.
Oh, could have been sponsored by like Glasgow Town Council. Is that a state? I don't know what counts. Probably not under a principle of Westphalia.
They've probably got
a
city council, what with them being a city, etc. Yes.
So yeah, Glasgow City Council have breached Yahoo's defences and leaked one account for every 16 people in the world, or maybe 14 people. I forget how many people there are in the world at the moment, but lots of accounts. And this was a few years ago, so if you've been using Yahoo and the same password for other accounts, change them and check for suspicious activity originating in Glasgow.
Hang on a minute, you said this is a few years ago.
It happened a few years ago, it's only been announced recently.
It was 2014.
Yeah.
Oh, I see.
And they thought that if they kept quiet, no one would notice.
I know a few Yahoo users. I've had some weird spam from Yahoo users a while back who presumed that their Android phones had been hacked and so forth. But
But Yahoo also provides services for, is it Sky? And oh, BT, that's the one. So if you've got a BT broadband account and you've got an email address with that, that's provided by Yahoo.
I do.
It's Sorry, stinky. Andrew. It's very, very stinky.
Yahoo hasn't asked me to change my password.
Well, me, actually.
And I've got an account with Yahoo that I'm pretty certain I haven't changed the password in all those years. Not that everyone's going to now go out looking for my account on Yahoo. But I still use it for Yahoo groups. And I'm the maintainer of a couple of groups, so it would actually be quite bad.
Yeah.
I thought Yahoo groups were just sort of front ends to mailing lists or something.
Yeah. They used to be old mailing lists, and then they brought it into... It was pre-Yahoo days. Not pre-Yahoo, pre-Yahoo groups.
I'm wildly insecure, and I used to use the same password for Yahoo and Amazon. And about 6 months or so ago, Amazon emailed me and told me that they thought my password had been leaked by another account and asked me to change it, but wouldn't tell me any more information than that.
Well, I haven't used it for this Yahoo leak, and I don't know if the details are on. Is it? Have I been pawned? But
I don't think it is on there.
No, because the data probably hasn't been leaked.
Yeah.
But certainly, a couple of my accounts show up on that from the various leaks over the last 6 months, which have been horrendous. Hmm. Last FM, for example.
I'm going to go and look up your passwords now.
Yeah. That probably is my account on Yahoo.
Yeah. So, yeah, in terms of protecting yourselves, is there anything people can do other than just change their passwords and use different... I guess the main one for this is use different passwords for different accounts and, where possible, two-factor authentication.
Yeah.
But to a certain extent, there's not a huge amount you can do if you've got data in the cloud and the cloud bursts.
It just shows you how incredibly unsuitable passwords are for this internet future that we're all living in. You can't realistically remember all your passwords, so you end up using a password manager which encrypts all of your passwords with one single password and basically isn't any more secure. No. And nowadays you can have access to everything, you know, medical history even, bank details. I know everybody already knows this.
I was trying to get into one of my accounts with the government gateway thing today, and I couldn't remember my password, but I've got a list of, you know, a few Roman era battlefields. just worked it out. He's just eventually. I think if I could do it, then God, the city of Glasgow Council could probably do it too.
Did you start with a map of medieval Europe and just go through it square by square?
Yeah.
All right, let's have a look what's next up on our list of news this fortnight. This fortnight, Libre Boot and GNU, or GNU, depending on how you prefer to pronounce your African animals. I've got into a bit of a scrap with Libre Boot leaving the fold of GNU. And there's been various arguments about what's caused it, and whether it's the gender or transgender nature of the project leader, or whether it's more to do with personality conflicts within the two projects.
I think the maintainer of Libre Boot, they're not involved directly in an employee of the FSF being let go. Their Libre Boot project is protesting the reasoning behind this person being let go from the FSF, and has purposely separated from the GNU as best as they can. However, this person seems to be acting on their own, because they're the default for like GitHub pushes for Libre Boot, and doesn't necessarily represent the entire Libre Boot community. And there's all kinds of issues over whether the project can actually separate itself from GNU after becoming part of it. And even Richard Stallman, I think, has chimed in saying that the person at the FSF was transgender when they employed them, and was transgender when they left, and it was never an issue, it was never a part of it. So I think from my perspective, and I think from quite a few people's perspective, the maintainer of the Libre Boot project has mentioned specifically some of the people involved at the FSF who have been involved in this case, and I think that's quite unacceptable. But otherwise, it's a very contentious issue, I think, for the Libre Boot project, and I don't know what the end result of it is going to be.
No, I mean, it's a difficult. I mean, the Libre Boot project is doing some really both important and great work in terms of getting...
So it's a free BIOS replacement.
Yeah, so the idea is you'll be able to run a PC or laptop or whatever completely with free software, so get rid of all the proprietary stuff as much as... Well, I say completely, down to the management engine or whatever they call it on the Intel chips. So all the software that you can access, from BIOS...
Oh, yeah, you're right. I forget about that, because actually in the CPU now, there's some kind of proprietary firmware that's booted up, isn't there?
Yeah.
It's terrible.
Yeah, so the computer itself is running...
code that we don't know what it's doing.
Yeah, closed source software.
Yeah.
But other than that, this also... Well, I suppose also your hard drive is running proprietary software, as is your network. There's a lot of proprietary software, to be honest, but this gets rid of quite a bit of it. On a machine, and at the moment they work on a few, probably like Lenovo machines, isn't it the IBM ThinkPads made by Lenovo that Libre Boot works on, and it's always a little bit sad to see politics come into free software in this way, when it sort of drives projects apart. And I guess the best we can hope for is that the differences can be resolved and it can focus on the software again.
Yeah, and perhaps not so much in the public domain as it has been, but yeah, I'm sensitive that this is a very sensitive issue.
Yeah.
And unusual for GNU, really, the GNU, the FSF, which I think I have no idea, but you'd expect to be very egalitarian and setting a good example in how it should behave with its employees. And I'm not saying it isn't, but the fact that this kind of controversy has, happened must say something about the way that it manages it.
Does the Free Software Foundation have a code of conduct the same way that many, many other software, like GNOME and stuff, do?
That's a good question.
It's like, I think there's a tendency to think, if you're... If you think of yourselves as good guys, then you don't need you can imagine that you don't need to write it down, because you just know that everyone will do the right thing. Whereas really, you can protect yourself by having a written policy, and so if there are allegations of bullying in the workplace, for example, you've got a written roadmap of what to do and what not to do. Whereas from the sounds of it, it looks like the Free Software Foundation haven't done that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely. I think you're right. I think that's a really good point. I think it's only like 10 employees. It's 8 employees, isn't it? Plus two. Right,
so why would you bother then? Why would you bother with the code of conduct? Since you know them all, you've been out, got drunk with them, and you know that nobody's an arsehole.
I think it's 10, including 2 people paid for by Mozilla.
Should we end on some happy news?
Yes, please.
Happy news this fortnight is that both the Raspberry Pi Foundation and Let's Encrypt have passed 10 million users. So, well, I say users. Let's Encrypt have issued 10 million certificates. Raspberry Pi have sold 10 million boards. I assume it's not one certificate for every board, but I have no way of knowing that's definitely not true.
Actually, I reckon Les Pounder has about 50,000 of those.
Certificates or boards?
Both. It's encrypting everything.
Yeah,
that's fantastic. Well done. Well done, Raspberry Pi people. I note today that one of our esteemed authors, the aforementioned Les Pounder, has been invited to Buckingham Palace to break bread with one of our Greek aristocracy. If you want to read a tutorial by a man who could very well put the words "by royal appointment" after his name now, I think, you can do so by buying Linux Voice issue 32.
Yep, which is on sale to the royal family.
It's on sale in the United Kingdom on Thursday. So cool. Go out and
that's
buy it.
Today. That's the day that this is going out.
Wow. Synergies.
Do we know whether or not Les is taking a copy to just leave it lying around, perhaps in a Buckingham Palace toilet for someone to read?
You know what? I bet he hasn't. You know what? I bet he probably has. And we can look forward to a fresh wave of subscriptions from the royal family.
They'll want them for free.
God bless them and save them.
And that's the news this fortnight.
Excellent news. Thank you, Ben. So, it's time for Finds of the Fortnight, isn't it? I'm not very well prepared. I haven't asked the IRC channel because it's all been a bit chaotic being at Ben's. However, if I remember correctly, yesterday, people on the Linux Voice IRC channel on Freenode, and Freenode does seem to have been having all kinds of problems, actually said that they've got some finds, so I should try and do a shortcut for find.
Is this their subtle way of telling us we're late with the podcast?
Okay, so they just volunteered. So Mavericks said sometime yesterday, one of my latest finds is that the FSFE has some great promotional material, and then they link to a spread the word, basically like a page advert, which is really good. I think we've seen them before and mentioned it maybe when Mike and I went to see the FSFE and got a load of promotional material off them. They say, my favorite is the sticker that says, there is no cloud, just other people's computers. I've seen that on quite a few.
Yeah.
There's a bit of a discussion then about whether that is a good find or not. And there was one more, as I remember. Let's see if I can remember where it is. Find. So this is in GoGo. I have a find. Our government has a Reddit account. It's /user/UK House of Commons. is that official? Or is that just, some time wasting at lunch?
I don't know.
So there's one more as well. This is from Devilment. Find of the Fortnight, one that he thinks I like. It's music related. It's called Music IP. It fingerprints your music collection so that it can suggest other tracks in your collection based off a seed track. And for those that miss having MP3 tag on Linux, there's Puddle Tag. I've never heard of that, which is a similar in terms of layout, etc. That's docs.puddletag.net. He then follows up by saying that He may scrub his Music IB find by change it to Beats, a command line version of Music Brain's Picard. I think we may have done a tutorial on Beats, or at least in Picard in Linux Voice. Basically, these are tools that generate a kind of a fingerprint for the music on your music collection, so that they can more easily check for duplicates and compare them with the same fingerprints for music stored online to build accurate databases without relying on spelling mistakes in metadata and that kind of stuff. It's really useful if you've got a huge collection.
It also seems like complete magic, the way it manages to work, complete despite just random different compressions used on all different files and whatnot.
Yeah, I don't actually know how it works. And I mean, it'd be quite interesting to look into what, I guess it's like a spectrographic footprint for a piece of music that if you choose a narrow enough bandwidth, it'll be the same on whatever kind of compression or whatever format you're using. Yeah. But I don't know. I have no idea. I'd like to look into that.
We could also see if you sing a track, can you get it good enough that they'll match you up with it?
I bet you could do like Winds of Change. Like at least the beginning. Yeah, I've put that in your head now for a whole week.
Awesome win.
So thanks everyone on the Linux Voice channel on Freenode. Does anyone want to share their find here?
Yes, please. I've got awesome finds. And my first find is a Twitter account called Parliament Edits. And it keeps track of all the Wikipedia edits made from parliamentary IPs. So
does it cache them?
So, what does that mean?
I mean, does it store them so that, because they're so often deleting them when they've changed their mind or been proven wrong?
I don't know. I imagine the wiki Twitter thing is just kept there. I don't know, to be honest. I don't know. I've only just found it now. I've got a quiz, right? So we were talking about the old Yahoo state-sponsored terrorism. Because how could poor tiny little Yahoo stand up to the might of a state? They obviously bear no blame at all. So TalkTalk were hacked last year, and it resulted in the loss of 160,000 customers' credit card and bank details. Profits fell from £32 million. To £14 million. Here's the question. Pay attention. What do we think happened to the remuneration of the chief executive?
Oh! Did it go up?
Yeah. Ben wins. Total package went from just over 1 million to 2.8 million.
Wow.
Wonderful. Capitalism for the win.
But it would have been so much worse if it wasn't for his.
Exactly.
And I'm going to say his because it's like 99 out of 100.
Sexism! Baroness Harding is one of our most well-renowned baronesses. She's, despite doing a less than stellar job, arguably, she is still a baroness. I guess if you're a constituent of Western Supermare in Somerset, you can write to your MP and ask him why his wife is still a baroness.
Can we ask Gladys to ask what? The Queen?
Yeah, that'd be awesome. So third discovery is that this Saturday just gone was the 950th anniversary of the Battle of Stamford Bridge.
So you're giving your password away now.
Okay. So I went along to a reenactment and it was absolutely fantastic. It was brilliant. The Archbishop of York turned up and made a really just wonderfully historically well-informed and jokey speech commemorating the massive loss of life. And it tacked on a prayer on the end, and I didn't mind because he was just like such a really nice fella. And there was beer, and there were Vikings, so just massively winning hugely all round.
Shall I go with my finds now?
Yeah.
I have two finds this fortnight. The first one is a proxy command, which is flagged to SSH, or you can put it in your SSH config. And it's particularly useful if you need to bounce through one host onto another. So in the particular situation I was doing, I had virtual networks and machines. I needed to SSH into them from a machine that wasn't the host of the virtual machines, if that makes sense. So I had to SSH into the host of the virtual machines, then SSH into the virtual machines. Rather than do two SSHs, set up the proxy command to be an SSH into the host, and that you can then SSH. I've confused myself now. Anyway, you can then log into the virtual machine remotely without having to faff around with that sort of thing. Just set it up in your SSH config file. Works a treat. My second find is that there is a really annoying bug in Ansible when using proxy command with SSH. This particular case was I had two different machines hosting virtual networks, and they were hosting networks in the same way. So I was effectively logging into the same user and IP address on two different machines, but because I was bouncing it through a different proxy on each one, they were actually different virtual machines. But Ansible was getting confused and thought it was the same machine. So I think it was caching the connection or something like that, but it was only ever logging into the same machine, even though the SSH setup was correct. And I spent ages trying to work out why. Nothing was changing on the one machine. It was working. The script seemed to be running fine. It was logging in. The change wasn't made. Oh, it's a really annoying bug. And those are my two finds.
God, they were complicated finds. shall I share my finds? So one of my finds you might have read about today, and it's the restoration of the first computer-generated music recording. It was made in 1951, and it was Alan Turing programming one of his old computers. I think it's one of those computers we featured in Linux Voice in Manchester. But anyway, I won't play it, but I'll stick it into the podcast maybe at the end. It's a very simplistic recording. I think there was another developer as well. I call them developers, but these were the first programmers that have ever existed. They basically programmed their computer to play tunes for the first time. This is the first time this had ever been done. And the sound of it, so it was God Save the King, Bar Black Sheep, and Glenn Miller's In the Mood. And it's quite a nice recording if you listen to it, because you can hear them all chatting and laughing at how silly it sounds. And also, it's not always in key. The recording was made, I think, onto acetate by the BBC in 1951. And the computer that made it the computer that made the sounds has been destroyed, and so is the code. So the only thing we had was this kind of acetate version that was recorded on a piece of equipment where the speed fluctuated and the recording quality was generally awful. So a couple of people have written some code to make sure that the pitch stays constant throughout the recordings and tried to fix the variations in pitch. I will say that actually, having listened to it, I think they've overdone the noise reduction because it makes everything sound a little bit tinny when perhaps it doesn't in the original. But it's a real, really compelling recording. It sounds like, I don't know if anyone remembers this, but do you remember on the Amiga you could make music with the floppy drive by so I the code would destroy your floppy drive, but basically you made the motor modulate at different speeds that created a genuine pitch, so you could play it sounded a little bit like a cello or a violin. And quite a few demos used this, and this is, I don't know what output device they were using, but it sounds very much like this. There's some physical part of it that's vibrating at a certain frequency to create the sounds.
Somebody, there are some YouTube videos of people stringing together multiple floppy drives so that they can, play in counterpoint different melodies at the same time. And it's just, it's something to behold, really.
Yeah.
What a world we live in.
So do we know if it was custom-made audio hardware or they were hacking some part of their computer to make the...
Well, for Alan Turing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know, actually. I meant to look it up before I did this. It sounded like they were just using some, you know, like some kind of controller and making it vibrate rather than actually generating sound that went to a speaker, which obviously they had the technology to do.
Yeah.
Too bad research on my part. My other find is that I've been, about 6 months ago, I did a photogrammetry tutorial in Linux Voice. I actually created a 3D model of the robot that you built, Ben, by taking like 20 photographs. And I've got back into it. In fact, I was recently away and I took 700 photographs of an interesting location. And I've been trying to build a model out of this 700 photographs. So what this does is it's like magic, and you can use open source tools to do it. You take 700 photographs or as many photographs as you can. You basically feed the photographs into the software. And the software then, using variations in the parallax and identifying all the objects in those photographs, creates points in 3D space and textures, so that you basically create a 3D model of what it is that you're taking a photograph of. So it could be a cup on the table, but it can also be locations like statues or, you know, like an actual place, like in a museum or something. And the results, when you do it well enough and you get good at it, are photorealistic and incredibly, it's like a 3D photograph that you can walk around. And some of the best software for doing this is open source. And in particular, there's a piece of software called Cloud Compare that once you've generated this cloud of points, there are no vertices in this. It isn't a 3D model. And it's actually a really horrendously complicated process. I've got 32 gig of RAM on my machine, and 700 photographs generates hundreds of gigabytes of data that needs to be processed in RAM to create 3D model out of these points. And this piece of software, it's called Cloud Compare, does it in like 16 gigabytes of RAM and creates a 3D object out of all these points of whatever size you want. So a location of about, I don't know, a quarter of an acre could be 4 million, 5 million vertices with maybe many more million points. It all sounds very geeky, but the end results are really good. And the software that does it is open source, and it's well worth a look if you're into this kind of geeky stuff. And it creates great output.
So the 700 photos that you took, do you have to do them in a particular way or just generally around the object?
No, you don't have to do it. It works better if you do it in a specific way. But actually, the photographs that I took, I can't show you the results now, but I actually just ad hoc, I stood in one place and then did a different panoramic shot. And then I went to a different location and did a panoramic shot. So it was very unscientific. You have to lock the exposure, if you can, on your camera. And use an uncompressed image format if you can. So I used RAW straight off my camera. But no, it's incredibly intelligent at detecting the part of a cup in one image and recognizing it in another image and then calculating the 3D space out of the differences in the two. It's really cool because you get like, it basically looks like the results of LiDAR or 3D scanning. It's exactly the same. And when you build the vertices out of a location and you don't apply the texture, you see all kinds of patterns. Like there's a very old wall where I was doing this. And you can see without the textures, how the bricks were kind of laid, which you don't see in real life. You can just see each row of the bricks. And just like LiDAR kind of reveals hidden temples and things like that. It's fascinating.
I still haven't even really managed stitching together panorama shots.
Well, this does it all for you. It's like automatic. Yeah. They're my finds. I think we're going over to Elon Musk now. Yeah.
So live here from Guadalajara, or whatever you call it.
Musky Elon.
You need a Mexican.
If only we had one, like in the good old days, yeah. Just before this Just so before we start recording this episode, listeners, there was the live announcement of SpaceX's Mars colonization architecture by our good buddy Elon Musk. So I was watching it just before we start recording, it's really, really fascinating. Elon is not a good speaker at all. He comes out onto stage with no music and he starts talking about engine pressures. Everybody's like, how are we going to go to Mars? What are we going to do? And he's like, well, we need to consider the impact of metal ox on. But that's what I love about him. He is a total geek. He's an absolute geek at heart. And he's genuinely committed to doing this. He's not a flashy salesman. He's not somebody who's like, oh, give me a bit of money and I'll do this. He's a geek with a lot of money and quite a bit of business savvy. But he wants to go and live on Mars and take people to Mars. And he knows a lot about how to do it. So, yeah, I'm still processing all the information. I guess I'll spend most of my day tomorrow watching all that. But it's just pretty cool. As a geek, I love it. I absolutely love all this stuff.
You would go then? You would go with him? You would leave us all behind and go to Mars?
Well, what he said tonight was he wants to get it down to the $200,000 per head range. So if he can take about 100 people per trip to Mars, 200,000. If you've got a reusable rocket, it's not actually that crazy a number. Everything's so ridiculously expensive at the moment because we throw all our rockets in the sea because it's the way we built them. If we get reusable rockets and a lot of other reusable stuff, $200,000 per person to go to Mars. And you can come back because they're going to send the spaceships back. There's no reason to leave them on Mars. That'd just be a waste of money. It's just a purely capitalist thing. So I don't know. Right. Giant-ass radioactive
desert. How long
would
it take to get to Mars?
Because they're going to refuel in space instead of just putting it there and sending it on trajectory, about 3 months. So three months in a small sort of caravan thing.
So will it be, are they going to have hydrogen fuel engines or military fuel?
Methane, actually. It's all going to be cow farts. So, and apparently there's a big source of cow farts on Mars. Or at least you can recreate cow farts on Mars. So,
Strumpf gas.
Exactly, yeah. So methane's pretty good for that. Meanwhile, back on planet Earth, I did discover something that I've not used, so it's not the greatest discovery, but I have heard, a little bird tells me that there's an Amiga operating system-like distribution for the Raspberry Pi called Amoebian. Have you heard of this, Graham? Have you heard of it, Andrew?
Yeah,
tell me.
I've heard of it, yes.
What have you heard about it?
I've only heard of it because it was mentioned in the Voice of the Masses comments. Coming soon.
Oh, great. Well, even better. But I've got a Raspberry Pi sitting around and it sounds like you can install an Amiga emulator, an Amiga OS on it and, you know, just with a few clicks. And then for all of us, I know Graham, you know, reminisces about the Amiga like I do, that if you can put this SD card in, plug it into your TV and you've got an Amiga, then great. Look, let's see what the Voice of the Masses has to say about that.
Can you make the SD card make music?
Or make it vibrate at certain frequencies.
Yeah, and then click, and then stop working.
Oh, yeah.
So your parents have to go drive to Argos on Boxing Day to get it fixed. Yeah.
It was awful replacing the drive in those early 500s. It's terrible.
The Amiga, some of the Amigas were so badly made. Anybody who's like, oh, Commodore was great. No, the Amiga was great. Commodore sucked.
They did. I think that is as close to official opinion as you can get.
Yeah, thanks, Graham. Yeah.
So, by my count, we're 45 minutes into this recording, which means it's time for the halfway reminder. Still to come, there's some stuff, including Vocalize Your Neurons and Voice of the Masses. If you're enjoying this so far and you'd like to subscribe to a magazine that has similar topics but in a more concise package, why not go to shop.linuxvoice.com and subscribe to Linux Voice, the magazine.
Exactly. I think you can't afford not to subscribe.
Yeah, listeners didn't see, but there was a real Chuck Norris pose then at the end of that.
I think I'm going to have to go out and buy the magazine now.
Yeah, so we actually, I've had like 6 or 7 neurons sent to me since the last podcast, which is bizarre.
Wow, what's like, happened?
I don't know. We normally have none or a few XML files sent to me, but yeah, like actual things I can read out have been sent to me. So,
are you going to read them all out or ration them for the next year?
I am. I'm rationing them out, Ben. Like you say, here's a little sample I've chosen.
It's getting late.
Yeah. So these are my caramel kegs from the Roses box. My favourites that I've chosen this time. The first is from Jonas Otten, or I guess Jonas if he's not German, but I don't know. And he says, when you were talking about the licensing stuff in the last episode of your podcast, it has come to my mind that GitHub is offering a page called ChooseALicense.com, where they try to break down the most common licenses into some easy, understandable words, not just for software projects. They point out, in just a few bullet points, what the permissions, conditions, and limitations of the different licenses are. Yeah, Jonas, that's a great site to point out, ChooseALicense.com. You don't have to read the licenses before you make a decision. You go there and you say, what do I want to do with my software, or my music, or my stories, or anything else? And that's the way it should be. It's really, really, it's sold really, really well. This is how I think we should approach a lot of free software and open source marketing. And instead of saying, oh yeah, here's a 60,000 word document where the bullet points begin from zero and stuff, and you've got to understand it, if not you're not geeky enough. What do you want to do? If we want free content out there, we want Creative Commons, and it's a really, really good page, and it's well worth checking out. And then Duncan J. Murray emails to say, there are several high-profile places where people know that you can find Linux, servers, supercomputers, NASA, CERN, etc. But I've realized that you don't often hear of Linux having a key role in the future of modern medicine. I'm talking about next-generation sequencing and understanding the human genome. It took 20 years and $2.7 billion to sequence the original human genome in the 1990s, whereas nowadays it takes as little as a day or two and you get change from $1,000. Almost all the software runs exclusively on the Linux command line. Most of it is GPL licensed, and the rate of development is fast. Yep, thanks, Duncan. It's a good point. We always talk about, you know, this is the year of Linux, and because it's on the server, because it's dominating mobile and creeping up on the desktop, and we'd love it for that. But what I really love is reading about where Linux is doing the digital plumbing on spacecraft and working out what makes a human, working out the mysteries of the universe. Linux is there grunting away, doing the hard work, and that's fascinating. So thanks, guys, for your neurons. If anybody else has anything they want me to vocalize, then email it to me at mike@linuxvoice.com.
And join the queue.
And join the queue, but you know, I will shift things up the queue. If they mention Bark or Frontier or SpaceX, then you know they will get a slightly higher priority. I'm only human, you know. I can't.
$1,000 to sequence a human genome.
Well, yeah, that's what Duncan said. I can't verify the stats off the top of my head, but I guess he's sort of saying that, you know, a Raspberry Pi of today is still way, way orders of magnitude more powerful than your computer in the early 90s. Or, you know, at least now you could bundle.
That's absolutely incredible.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet what we're using them for? For cat pictures. So. Sorry, Ben.
Yeah, we don't know what sequencing a genome is.
Well, there's like an enormous amount of data.
Mm. Yeah, it's taking the unraveling your DNA and cutting it into all of its constituent blocks.
So sequencing sort of picks out these bits and says, is that what it's doing?
Yes, it does. And also, I think it's getting the workable DNA in the first place, which I don't think is straightforward.
I can just see a Linux Voice tutorial coming up where Ben makes a Raspberry Pi motor to sequence your cat's DNA.
Mm. The cat must first be pickled in amber.
Do you know, you're not allowed... I was going to use this as a discovery, but it's too weird, I think. So I'll just say it now instead. You're not allowed to perform aromatherapy on your cat without a vet's permission.
Oh, wow.
Because it, well, at least in the UK, because it's not considered able to consent to smelling things. I don't say this. I read it on one internet site somewhere and couldn't verify it, so it might be nonsense.
That's a deprived subreddit that you're reading right now.
That sounds like political correctness gone mad. And it sounds like the sort of thing that we don't have to put up with now that we've taken back control.
It's probably an EU law, surely.
Probably the French.
Yeah. French. Oh.
Now we're halfway to being great again. We don't have to worry.
So, with that brings us skidding elegantly, like Tokyo Drift, towards the voice of the masses. Tokyo Drift is amongst the Fast and Furious franchise. Tokyo Drift, I feel, is the most underrated. It's not the best, but it is the one that deserves more plaudits than it gets. So, voice of the masses, what cool stuff are you doing with your pie? Lots of cool stuff. Let's fast forward to satisfy Mike. So Wald says, when I get the chance, I'm going to try Amoebian, an Amiga type distribution for the pie. Duncan Murray says, yeah, similar thoughts. It's a toss-up between RetroPie and Amoebian. Duncan Murray also says, PS, I don't know if people have heard Ben Vost, the last editor of Amiga Format, who took over from Nick Veitch, interviewed on the Retro Gaming Podcast. It's worth a listen, and where I first heard about Amoebian. And then he gives a URL, which no doubt we will disseminate and share among the masses. And I've just shared it among the little masses here.
Hang on, so Duncan J. Murray, that was the comment you read out, Andrew? From Duncan,
yes, that's
Murray.
Right.
Oh, he's having a bonanza in this podcast because he just had a neuron as well. He's had a neuron and a vocalise. Ah, taking over the podcast.
Thanks, Duncan.
Now, yeah. Viking Penguin is a man after my own heart. He says his pie is collecting dust in a drawer. So, the Raspberry Pi, then, they've sold 10,000 units. Enormously successful.
10,000, yeah.
10,000. Why make billions when we can make millions? 10 million units. That's absolutely fantastic. It's all for charity and all about making computing great again. Ben, you're a Raspberry Pi man, aren't you?
Yeah.
Have you been invited to meet the Queen?
I actually was, but I couldn't make it.
Oh, what?
I've got quite a few. Some of them doing something. Some of them not. One I'm going to do with one of my spare ones, I think, is there's a Commodore 64 emulator, which is probably the best gaming machine of its era. So relive the highlights of the 80s that way, I think.
I've got a load of Commodore 64 shells you can have if you want. I took all the SID chips out of them, but I've still got the rest of the computer. I asked all my friends if I could borrow their Commodore 64s. Honestly, I really have.
Will it, without the SID chip, will it work?
Yeah, actually it still works.
Do it produce any sound or just none?
No. I think the great thing is that it was kind of analog, you see, so yeah. It just sent it a load of signals and sent the audio to the composite output. So without them, it still works, but doesn't make any sound. Yeah. Unless you could attach a floppy drive and make that kind of over it.
So the SID chip is the C64 sound chip that's, some of them work and some of them don't, yeah?
Oh, well, the SID chips, yeah. So the SID chip is an amazing device. And they were made in batches each week. And the week number is printed onto each SID chip and the year. And they made them for, 10 years, 8 years. And in fact, there are Chinese companies still making them from... from the reverse engineered kind of, you know, how they kind of dissect chips, physically dissect and scan them. So the early SID chips are the ones that are very sought after. The later SID chips aren't bad at all, but they're too perfect. The early ones all kind of suffer from Commodore's shoddy manufacturing. 1984 to 1986 is what you really want.
Aside from retro gaming, the garden watering system has been a long-term project of mine. So the plumbing's all working now, it waters, but it doesn't monitor the rainfall, it doesn't monitor the moisture of the earth, so it doesn't know quite the right amount of watering to give, and that's definitely up there on my to-do list, though it's not there yet. The issue I've been having is it's quite a long way out to the garden. I want to get the readings from the moisture back in. And I got an ESP8266 board with a detachable Wi-Fi antenna, but I can't get it to boot that one. I've got ones without detachable antennas that boot fine, and I don't know if this one's broken or I'm just incapable of using it properly. But anyway, I need to get some method of getting the information back. So I might use one of the longer range radios. I've got an SRF module that I could use with it to get the moisture back so I can know when to turn on and off the water. That's my next Raspberry Pi project.
Over to the masses now. And if you, like me, have a Raspberry Pi gathering dust in a drawer, I totally recommend you go to this thread, because everyone's got a different idea. Everyone's doing something different and cool and clever and useful. So, David R., I use one as a recipe calculator in a bakery, as it doesn't have a fan, so flour can be vacuumed out occasionally. Brilliant. Dick, my older Pi is for IRC channels on IRSSI and a print server for the home network. Mark Fraser, I have one connected to a weather station and uploading it to Wonderground and Twitter. Another one taking photographs of the sky, which it uploads to Twitter every hour, and that my server creates a time-lapse video every night. A third one is used as a video baby monitor. Another one is a print server. Keith Ellis has too many. One was an own cloud server based on our early tutorial, currently transferring to Nextcloud. One in a bird box streaming live pictures, one controlling RF sockets, another displaying the temperature of the bird box with a sense hat. Ray Woods is busy really playing cool golf. Espada V8. Now this sounds cool to me. Currently just the one that's acting as a temperature humidity sensor in our office and pushing it out via PubNub and into SimpleDB and then rendering to a static JS-driven D3/C3 site hosted on Amazon S3. For a temperature sensor, that just seems like massive overkill to me.
It's a thermometer, is what you've got.
Kudos, yeah, exactly.
The little ones with a bit of metal, you had to move up and down with a magnet so you could read the highs and lows.
Yeah. Pixelated Pete is making a pimpkin for Halloween. Peter, I'm trying to attach a Raspberry Pi Zero with a camera to a toy parachute to throw them from the balcony. The only thing that's missing is a transparent, cheap and solid case so the Raspberry Pi and camera can be reused. Bit of an Elon Musk SpaceX thing there. Reuse them, bring the cost down.
Is that like the new version? I don't know if you ever did this, where you have to try and get the egg, drop it without the egg breaking.
Oh, yeah. The Great Egg Race.
Yeah, yeah, you have to sort of, you have like some cardboard and paper and whatnot, and you have to make it all work.
Yeah.
Is the modern version doing it with a Raspberry Pi without breaking it when it hits the ground?
Maybe.
Sounds like a step backwards to me. Not all change is progress. Not all progress is good, whatever it is. Scythe has been doing lots of mad stuff, which just is sciencey and I don't understand it. Tommy Hellander has three Pis. One is my RetroPi console. One works as our domestic file sharing and backup server. And the last one hosts my girlfriend's low traffic WordPress playground. Mark W. We have a few around our chemistry research lab. One is hooked up to a barcode scanner and label printer so we can manage our chemical inventory. The other one is hooked up to a temperature probe that monitors the temperature inside our battery testing enclosure. Just cool stuff. People are doing real things.
I know. When the Raspberry Pi first came out, it was one of the first sort of computers that you could use Linux on that you could really easily hook up to stuff. You'd be able to use Arduinos and whatnot, but there's quite a big sort of step up to be able to use them, especially if you want to get the data in and out over the network. But with the Raspberry Pi, it just made it so easy to connect stuff in and sort of place them somewhere and forget about them. And it was that's what makes it so much more than just a cheap computer, I think. The fact that it's so embeddable, so interactive, you can do so many things with it.
Yes, that and the huge community of users who are always on hand to give advice, etc. Right, that's a massively positive way to end it. Mike's just poured himself another glass of foreign muck.
It's 11. It's 11 in the evening here. I mean, you know, I've just watched an Elon Musk speech. I'm allowed a beer.
So, Ben and Graham, I guess you're going to drink some of Ben's homemade cheesy feet cider.
I've got a scratcher and press rented for this weekend. Went scrumping last weekend, got a big stack of apples in the living room.
Living the dream.
Yeah.
Wonderful. I'm going to go downstairs and drink beer that was made by somebody else. which I bought in a shop with money. And that's all the weather. So that's the inspirational message to leave you all with, listeners. Thanks for tuning in. Last fortnight, we had 6,400 of you. You were probably confused and looking for something else. but we hope you liked it, and we hope you come back. So until then, until 2 weeks' time from now, adieu.
Yep.
Stay strong.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.